morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Today is Thursday, April the 21st, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you this morning. Hundreds of Ethiopians lined up outside the Russian embassy in Addis Ababa this week in hopes of being recruited to fight for Moscow in its invasion of Ukraine.
He says, "We are former members of the Ethiopian army. We do not have a job at the moment. We have heard that the Russian embassy is now recruiting, and we are here with our credential."
In Kenya, secondary school heads want to be allowed to carry out drug tests on students as a way of curbing indiscipline.
Ministry of Education must come up with rules and regulations to manage the Children's Act in education institutions.
And three people were killed and 19 injured after an explosion at a crowded market in Nigeria's Taraba State in the east of the country. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. And for our top story, hundreds of Ethiopians lined up outside the Russian embassy in Addis Ababa this week in hopes of being recruited to fight for Moscow in its invasion of Ukraine. The embassy has dismissed claims it is recruiting foreign fighters and says that Ethiopians are there to show their solidarity with Russia. Gilmo Dawit reports from Addis Ababa.
For the past several days, Ethiopians have stood in long lines outside the Russian embassy in the capital. Their hope is to be accepted by Russia to take part in its invasion of Ukraine. Witnesses say the embassy is not bringing hopefuls inside, but say staffers have come outside to take documents.
Feleka Gebrekidan is among the Ethiopians who have spent long hours waiting outside the embassy. He has military experience. He says having served in the Ethiopian military for over a decade.
He says, "We are former members of the Ethiopian army. We do not have a job at the moment. We have heard that the Russian embassy is now recruiting, and we are here with our credentials. I have brought the clearance I got after serving in the military." Feleke says he has been at the gate of the embassy for 3 days, but has not managed to get inside. He says he plans to come back and try again. Tedros Sime lives next to the Russian embassy in Addis. He says he is not happy to see his fellow citizens volunteering for the war. "Why would I fight on behalf of foreign nation? I was so angry when people poured in for registration to the embassy. Many did not show up when the Ethiopian Ministry of Defense was calling to join our army. They are now bowing for Russians, and I'm sad about it. We should prioritize the peace of our country." Some of the volunteers are motivated by economics. They are desperate to get a job, even a potentially deadly job overseas, because they are unemployed. Also, most Ethiopians see Russia as a friendly nation politically. In 1980s, Ethiopia was under communist leadership, and there are thousands of Ethiopian military personnel who were trained in the Soviet Union. Maria Chernukina is the press attache for the Russian embassy in Addis Ababa. Speaking to VOA, she acknowledged that some in line are carrying documents, but say that reflects their own willingness and hope. She says the Russian embassy is not recruiting people for any purpose, and that would not comply with its responsibility as a diplomatic mission. Since the war began, she adds, Ethiopians have been calling and emailing the embassy to voice their solidarity with Russia. Chernukina says the line outside the embassy is also part of that. Contacted by VOA, the Ukrainian embassy in Addis Ababa declined to say anything about the lines. The Ethiopian Ministry of Foreign Affairs did not respond to a request for a comment. Gilmo Dawit for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
The Uganda People's Defense Forces and troops from the Democratic Republic of Congo have foiled an attack by rebels on a health center in the eastern DRC. This comes as the joint armies continue fighting to eliminate the Allied Democratic Forces rebels from the DRC forests. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Ugandan officials say 7 to 10 fighters with the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, attacked a health center in Nobiri village. Uganda People's Defense Forces, or UPDF, and DRC troops were patrolling the area. Major Peter Mugisha is the Ugandan Army spokesperson for the joint operation against ADF rebels called Operation Shujaa.
the joint forces, while they were conducting a hunting mission and the combing mission in Kakuka, had contact with the ADF remnants. They tried to attack, but our own force reacted immediately and repulsed the attack. On enemy side, two were put out of action.
He says the troops also seized weapons and ammunition from the rebels. Nabidi village in eastern DRC was the center of recent confrontations between the joint armies and the ADF, which resulted thousands of Congolese fleeing into Uganda's Bundibugyo district. The joint armies say they will maintain patrols in the area to prevent any attacks on civilians. Major Mugisha says there are intelligence reports that the ADF now is targeting medical facilities to get supplies to treat their injured colleagues. In a joint meeting early this week to assess the operation, which began late last year, the joint armies agreed on the need for additional forces to protect DRC citizens who return to their homes after they have been retaken from the rebels. Mugisha says the joint forces are overstretched by the rebels, who are highly mobile and fleeing in different directions. The ADF is an Islamist militia that originated in Uganda but has been operating in the DRC for more than a decade. It is among the deadliest of more than a dozen militia groups fighting in the eastern DRC. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
A court in Rwanda has sentenced a Chinese mining engineer to 20 years in prison after he was found guilty of tying his workers to a tree and whipping them. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
A Chinese citizen was convicted Wednesday in Rwanda on charges of torture, according to Rwandan media reports. Last year, a video circulated online showing Sun Shujian, the Chinese national, flogging two Rwandan workers who had been tied to a tree. Shujian said the two men had stolen minerals from his company, Ali Group Holdings Limited, Rwanda's KT Press reported. The Chinese embassy in Kigali condemned the unlawful acts in a statement at the time, according to local media. This is not the first time Chinese nationals working in Africa have been accused of abusing their local workers. In Zimbabwe in 2020, a Chinese coal mine owner shot and wounded two local workers after they complained about wages they were owed. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Three people were killed and 19 injured after an explosion at a crowded market in Nigeria's Taraba State in the east of the country. Osman Abdullahi, police spokesperson for Taraba, said the blast in the rural Iware community occurred on Tuesday at a drinking spot in a section of a busy market, leaving three people dead and more than a dozen people with injuries. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the attack. And in the Central African Republic, the inaugural trial of a court established to prosecute war crimes in the country's drawn-out conflict was postponed on its first day when lawyers for defendants boycotted proceedings. The trial is related to the massacre of 46 civilians in the northern villages of Kunjili and Lemona in May 2019. Prosecutors said the killings were carried out by the 3R rebel group. Three members of the group have been charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity. And the United Nations says that it is extremely concerned that Mali has prevented its investigators from visiting a town where local troops and suspected Russian fighters allegedly killed hundreds of civilians. At least 300 men are believed to have been summarily executed during a March 27 to 31st raid on Maura, a town of about 10,000 inhabitants infiltrated by Islamic militants. That is according to a Human Rights Watch report. This month, we celebrated the International Day for Street Children. The day provides a platform to debate issues concerning these homeless children that cannot be ignored. In Uganda, activists say the effects of COVID-19 has exacerbated their plight. And reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji has more from Kampala.
Street children are one of the most vulnerable but yet invisible populations in the world. Alana Kembabazi, who works with local NGO Initiative for Social and Economic Rights, says their numbers have increased on the streets of Kampala and surrounding areas.
It is worse. The issue of the children we are seeing on the streets are young. I'm talking 5, 6 years. They're everywhere. They're persistent. Some of them have personally approached me. I don't even ask for money, but just like if I have like sweet bananas in my car or some porridge or some soda, some food. So you get the sense that these are kids that are just really struggling to survive.
She says a study by organization shows that COVID-19 has worsened abject poverty and contributed to many children living on streets. She says some parents encourage their children to beg for money so they can feed their families. Alana says hundreds of children have not been able to return the classroom despite schools opening after nearly 2 years. That is because they cannot afford school fees or scholastic materials. It is hard to know how many children live on streets in Uganda, but rights activists say they number in the thousands. A 2018 survey conducted by NGOs Retrack and Hope for Justice in collaboration with Uganda's Minister of Gender says there's about 12,000 street children in 4 districts of Iganga, Jinja, Mbale and Kampala. Damon Wamara is the executive director of Uganda Child Rights NGO Network. He says the children face a lot of challenges, including a lack of shelter and access to education.
Many of them are beaten up, are pushed away, they are sexually violated, and they do not have any form of accessing justice for the crimes that have been committed onto them. Because of their vulnerability state, they're exploited and paid way below what they should be, what an ordinary person would be.
Wamala also says some children rights organizations are working with the government to integrate children with their families.
It's our God-given duties as parents to protect and serve these children. For those in Africa, we need to build on our strong culture base where no child was orphaned, no child would get lost, and the community, the clan, or the tribe would not care.
Wamala says his organization is embarking on teaching parents about the basics of parenting, for home ought to be the safest place for a child. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
And still in East Africa, in Kenya, secondary school heads want to be allowed to carry out drug tests on students as a way of curbing indiscipline. The idea is part of a conference in Mombasa that has brought together all head teachers and school administrators. They are also discussing other issues such as public funding, mental health challenges among teachers, and student unrest that rocked the nation last year. Moreno Jambo reports.
The 45th Annual Conference of Secondary School Principals kicked off in Mombasa as teachers contemplate how to bring discipline in schools that have suffered from unrest. Kenya Secondary School Heads Association Chairman Alfred Indimuli says the government should ensure laws are in place to punish students who misbehave.
Ministry of Education must come up with rules and regulations to manage the Children's Act in education institutions. It's not there. That is why you will find the students will walk scot-free whenever they make mistakes in schools, because there is no regulations.
The theme of this year's conference is re-examining the future together, a new era of education in Kenya. Indimuli says discipline is deteriorating among students and schools should be allowed to conduct mandatory tests for drug use among students.
If you look at the Children's Act, they have a responsibility towards their parents and a responsibility towards their nation. But there's no responsibility towards educational institutions. So they can break up things, they can ban their schools. The question we are asking ourselves is discipline going down? Principals, therefore, and teachers lacking the might to manage issues discipline.
Education expert Amos Kaburu says it is illegal to subject students to mandatory drug tests.
It's illegal. You cannot subject children to such kind of tests. And so let's admit that the adults making such suggestions are only but trying to enforce a deterrent mechanism. Otherwise, it has got no legal basis and it can be challenged in any reasonable court of law. So I think the adults who are making such suggestions could either be being naive, or let's admit that they're just trying to scare off children, for children to know that, yes, there will always be consequences to any behaviors that you get yourself engaged in.
The National Authority for the Campaign Against Alcohol and Drug Abuse in Kenya attributes the rise in cases of school unrest and indiscipline among primary and secondary school students to drug abuse, but Kaburu disagrees.
There is a difference between indiscipline and probably some of the things that we're witnessing. Yes, we got just to realize so many people who abuse drugs, but they don't walk around projecting their anger on innocent people and people's property. But I think it's a case of correlation that, yes, the very existence of drugs could also indicate also presence of indiscipline cases and sometimes projected in form of destruction of school property. But doesn't mean that drug abuse leads to destruction of property.
Both primary and high school students in Kenya are now on holiday and are set to resume classes next Monday. Stakeholders in education are blaming students' unrest on the failure to comply with safety standards and the collapse of guidance and counseling programs. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jembo in Sacramento, California.
Nigerian journalists on the front line of conflict reporting are receiving trauma support from a new media initiative. Timothy Obiezu has more from Abuja.
While the world focuses its attention on Russia,
you're listening to journalist and filmmaker Bivan Magoni voicing the trailer of his film about the sectarian violence ravaging his hometown in northern Nigeria's Kaduna State. He began the documentary in 2016 to raise awareness about the killings and to hold those responsible to account. But he says years of interviewing conflict survivors are taking a toll on his emotional well-being.
I go to a place where 40 dead bodies have been buried. I go to count graves of over 100 people being buried. Trust me, no matter how strong-willed you are, when you come back, it's going to take a toll on you. When women begin to tell you how their children were killed in their presence, when you come up across people, survivors, without limbs, whose hands were chopped off, their legs were cut off, and all of that.
Magoni says coverage of conflict is affecting his mood and making it hard to finish his documentary.
Trust me, if this was happening somewhere far away from home, I don't think I will have the capacity to put myself through this mental stress.
The World Health Organization estimates one in four Nigerians, some 50 million people, suffers from some form of mental illnesses, sometimes triggered by conflict or economic hardship. But access to psychological support at hospitals or with specialists is limited. That's a problem Nigeria's Center for Journalism, Innovation and Development wants to fix. Partnering with a psychological service group, the center offers support to newsrooms and free counseling to journalists experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Oluwatosin Alagbe is the operations director at the center.
Journalists see a lot of things, but they cannot represent them on their various mediums. So they need an outlet. A number of them go through PTSD. For one of the organizations that we held the session for, more than half of their staff were going through PTSD.
More than 100 journalists have benefited from the program since it started in 2019, including Aisha Babatunde, who covers the Boko Haram conflict for the Nigerian news website Human Go.
In the course of the program, I realized it was very important for me. We have to point out some of the things we go through mentally, stress. How do you react to this when you are stressed? How do you react? Are you passive, aggressive? So it was a real pointer to what exactly I was feeling.
Babatunde says her employers include periodic trauma support for its staff. Alagbe says the Journalism Center wants more newsrooms to welcome the initiative.
This program or this project is good to scale. I think every newsroom, if possible, should have an in-house therapist if you can.
The skills and support offered by the program could help journalists like Magoni, who is planning to attend a session very soon. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
In a new book out this month, author Jory Lewis takes an in-depth look at the history of the peanut in West Africa and the role of France's demand for peanut oil in the 19th century played in slavery in Senegal. Lewis spoke to Ricky Shryock about how slavery continued in some places in Senegal despite France's revolutionary rhetoric.
There's a kind of obvious hypocrisy in that, right? Of course, they had outlawed slavery in French holdings, and as the process of colonialism was not yet complete, Cajour and many of the other areas were not French territory, but they depended on these places for trade. So even though, especially in the, you know, late in 19th century, France has a kind of, you know, there's this kind of reemergence of the revolutionary values. They're supposed to be now like putting into practice the kind of revolutionary ideals that had first kind of like started during the French Revolution. And yeah, they're just not, for sort of call it like logistical reasons and maybe just like sheer cynicism, not able to put those things into practice. But at the same time, right, like this is a complicated distinction, right? Because obviously the people of Cajour had a right to have their own customs and practices. It's more like the sort of uncomfortable moment is really about that, the sort of hypocrisy of the French policy towards these places and their rhetoric about these places, and at the same time kind of like looking at their actions.
One of the other impacts you discuss in the book and is to the, you know, the environmental impact that this monoculture had.
So peanuts are hanging out in Africa, being grown on like a small scale for people like in their kitchen gardens to kind of as a complement to their diets, right? But then the French come and there's a demand for peanuts in Europe. Also, at the very beginning of the trade, there's quite a substantial demand from the United States. The production of peanuts is sort of scaled up, and as the sort of demand for peanuts increases, it pushes farmers to kind of maybe, let's say, put more land into production, so that eventually the peanut starts to sort of overtake other types of production, you know, especially millet.
It says that you looked at oral histories, epic poems. How important was that? You know,
epic poems, which are interesting, you know, these kind of, you know, there's like the Epic of Sunjata, or like there is a thing called the Epic of Cajour, right? So I use that, and there are a couple of versions of that. So that's, there are multiple layers, right? Because they're kind of like dueling oral historians who have different perspectives. Even though it's not the archive, it's still like the history of the leaders, of marabouts, of the elite. And then, you know, you have maybe like tales and fables and those types of things. And I try to use those to sort of show kind of like diffuse cultural influence of the peanut, of colonialism, of all of those things.
That was author Jory Lewis speaking to VOA's Ricky Shryock in Senegal. And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. For more African news and features, visit us at voanews.com. You can also connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Twitter, Instagram, and on Facebook. We are also on YouTube. Just search for VOA Africa. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead, Africa.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Encounter. Next, our periodic update on Africa. Susan Stigand, Africa Director at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and Joshua Mazurvi, Senior Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, discuss the scale and depth of Russian influence in Africa, especially the mercenary Wagner Group, famine in the Horn, the status of the Ethiopian conflict, and much more. An update on Africa, that's Encounter, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.